Welcome, Curious Minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're stepping onto the global stage, really. We're going to explore a concept that often sounds, well, pretty complex, maybe like financial wizardry, but it actually impacts nearly everything in your daily life. Things like, you know, the cost of that imported gadget, or even how competitive businesses right here at home are. We're talking about exchange rates. We've pulled together some really fascinating source material. It breaks down how these rates are measured, what makes them tick, and critically, their effects, which are really far-reaching on the broader economy. Our mission today. Let's try to cut through the jargon, illuminate the why it matters, and really get to the heart of this kind of intricate financial dance between currencies. Think of it as a journey, maybe, to understand who's leading and who's following in this global economic waltz.
Okay, let's unravel this. So if we're talking about currencies dancing, let's start with the absolute basics. What exactly is an exchange rate?
We see these numbers quoted all the time, but there are actually a few different ways to measure this, and, well, the distinction turns out to be pretty crucial.
It's true. The first one most people encounter is the nominal exchange rate. This is the most straightforward one. It's the rate you see, you know, quoted most commonly, maybe at a foreign exchange bureau or online. For instance, if you see that one U.S. dollar buys, say, 125 Nepalese rupees, that's it. That's your nominal rate. But here's the important thing to grasp, that raw number. It doesn't tell us anything about what that money can actually buy in each place. It completely ignores differences in price levels, inflation.
Right. So it's just the face value, the number itself.
Yeah.
But if I'm trying to figure out, you know, what my money can truly purchase somewhere else, doesn't that raw number miss something really important, like differences in living costs or inflation? How do we get a handle on that?
You've nailed the critical point there. That's exactly where the real exchange rate comes in. This rate adjusts the nominal rate. It factors in those inflation differences, giving us a much truer picture of a currency's comparative purchasing power. Think of it like this. It takes that basic nominal rate, but then adjusts it based on how prices actually compare in both countries. So let's say inflation is much higher overseas, then the real value of your currency might actually be stronger than the nominal rate suggests, which means effectively your goods become more expensive compared to their goods.
Okay, that makes sense. Adjusting for what things actually cost. And then going even broader, I think. Beyond just comparing two currencies, there's something called the trade-weighted exchange rate, or the effective exchange rate index. Why do we need this even wider view? What does that tell us?
Ah, yes. It's really essential if you want to understand a country's overall international competitiveness. It gives you the bigger picture. See, instead of just looking at, say, the dollar versus the euro, this index calculates an average value of a currency, but it's against the currencies of its major trading partners. And each partner's currency in that basket is weighted, you know, by how much trade actually happens with that country.
Ah, so it reflects who you actually trade with most.
Precisely. So if this index goes up, it indicates an overall appreciation against key partners. If it falls, it's an overall depreciation. It gives a much more holistic view of where a nation stands in global trade, much better than just one single rate.
Okay, so we've got the measurements down, nominal, real, and trade weighted. We know how to measure the dance steps, so to speak. But who's actually calling the tune, or maybe who's trying to influence the dance? We hear about different systems, fixed, floating, managed. How do these actually work? What's the difference?
Right. These systems basically dictate how much the government or the central bank gets involved. Let's start with the fixed exchange rate system.
Mm-hmm.
In this system, a country's currency is explicitly pegged, like tied to another currency or sometimes a basket of currencies. The central bank or the government then actively commits to keeping it at that level. It's a promise. For example, if a country decides to fix its currency at, say, one USD equals 100 units of their currency, the central bank is then responsible for maintaining that peg. They have to constantly work to keep it there. That often means buying or selling foreign reserves, maybe tweaking interest rates, or sometimes even imposing controls on foreign exchange. It's a constant effort.
Wow, yeah, that sounds like a lot of work for a central bank. Constantly intervening, managing reserves, just to keep that number fixed. It makes me wonder about the middle ground. You hear about a managed exchange rate system, sometimes called a dirty float. That sounds, well, a bit less rigid.
It is, absolutely. It's a hybrid system, kind of sitting right between the purely fixed and the purely floating ones. Here, market forces, supply and demand, are still the main drivers determining the exchange rate day to day. But the central bank reserves the right to step in, to intervene, occasionally.
Occasionally. Not all the time, like in a fixed system.
Exactly. These interventions aren't continuous. They're more strategic, maybe to smooth out really wild swings, you know, excessive volatility, or perhaps to achieve specific economic goals, like trying to control inflation or maybe give their exports a bit of a competitive boost, but without that full commitment of a fixed peg.
Okay, a bit more flexible then. And then all the way at the other end of the spectrum, there's the floating exchange rate system. This sounds like the most hands-off approach.
That's correct. In a pure floating system, the exchange rates are determined almost entirely by the raw forces of supply and demand playing out in the foreign exchange market, the Forex market. There's essentially no direct active intervention from the central bank aimed at hitting a specific rate target. The market just decides.
Right, so the market rules. Now, sticking with these floating systems, it sometimes feels like currency movements are almost, well, random or unpredictable. What are the real key drivers? What actually makes a currency get stronger, appreciate, or weaker depreciate in that kind of open market scenario?
This is where the dance gets really complex because, you know, many factors can push floating rates around. Big influences include differences in interest rates between countries. Higher interest rates can attract foreign investment, which boosts demand for that currency.
Money follows the higher return, basically.
Exactly. Then there are differing inflation rates. Lower inflation generally makes a currency more attractive. A country's overall political and economic stability plays a huge role, too. Investors like stability. And of course, you can't ignore speculation. Traders betting on future movements can actually create significant shifts all by themselves. It's a mix of fundamentals and psychology.
Okay, a whole bunch of factors interacting. Now, it seems like there's specific jargon, specific words for currency changes, depending on whether it's a fixed or a floating system we're talking about. Can you help us clarify the difference? We hear words like revaluation and devaluation, but also appreciation and depreciation. They sound similar, but I get the feeling the distinction is important.
It's absolutely crucial, yes. And it's a common point where people get a bit mixed up. Here's the key. Devaluation and revaluation only apply to fixed exchange rate systems. These are official government or central bank actions, policy decisions.
Only fixed systems, got it.
So devaluation is when a central bank deliberately reduces the official value of its currency under that fixed system.
Yeah.
It's an active policy choice. Why do it? Well, typically to make the country's exports cheaper and therefore more competitive on the global market. But there's a downside.
Which is?
Imports become more expensive for people at home. And that can lead to what we call imported inflation. Things just cost more.
Okay. And revaluation.
Revaluation is the opposite. It's a deliberate increase in the official value of the currency. Again, under a fixed system. Another policy decision. This makes imports cheaper, which can be good for consumers and can help dampen inflationary pressure. But the flip side is it can hurt domestic industries because their exports suddenly become more expensive for foreign buyers. Competitiveness can suffer.
So devaluation and revaluation are policy actions in a fixed system. What about in a floating system where the market is doing the moving? What words do we use then?
Right. In floating systems where market forces rule, we use appreciation and depreciation. Appreciation is simply an increase in a currency's value that happens because of market forces. Maybe there's higher demand for that country's goods, or capital is flowing in seeking higher interest rates, or maybe inflation is just really low and stable.
So the market pushes the value up.
Exactly. And the effects. They mirror revaluation. Imports become cheaper for domestic consumers, but exports become more expensive for foreigners.
And depreciation.
Depreciation is the opposite. A decrease in the currency's value, again, driven by market forces. Maybe interest rates are lower or imports are surging, or perhaps there's political instability making investors nervous.
The market pushes the value down.
Correct. And its effects are the reverse. Exports become cheaper, which can boost competitiveness, but imports become more expensive, and that can potentially fuel domestic inflation. And this, you know, this raises a really interesting question. How quickly do these changes, whether it's appreciation or depreciation, actually filter through and impact trade flows? Does it happen overnight?
That's a fantastic lead-in to the bigger picture, the deeper implications. Okay, so a currency moves, it depreciates or appreciates. What does this actually mean for the external economy, for the trade balance? And ultimately, you know, for your everyday life, we have these two classic economic concepts here that help paint a clearer picture, I think. The Marshall-Lerner condition and the J-curve.
Yes. If we zoom out now and connect these currency movements to the broader economy, these two concepts are, well, they're vital. They help explain the often counterintuitive relationship between exchange rate changes and a country's trade balance. It's not always straightforward. Let's take the Marshall Learner condition first. It basically lays out the conditions under which a currency depreciation will actually improve the trade balance.
Improve meaning exports rise more than imports fall or something like that, reducing a deficit.
Exactly. Reducing a trade deficit or increasing a surplus. But the condition states this improvement happens only if, and this is the crucial part, only if the sum of the price elasticities of demand for exports and imports is greater than one.
Okay, elasticities. That sounds technical. What does that mean in simple terms?
It fundamentally means how responsive demand is to a change in price. So, is demand elastic? Does it stretch a lot when price changes? Or is it inelastic, meaning it doesn't change much? So the condition says, if foreigners don't really buy significantly more of your exports, even when they get cheaper, inelastic export demand, or if your own country doesn't really cut back much on imports, even when they get more expensive, inelastic import demand.
Then depreciation might not help the trade balance.
Precisely. If the combined elasticity is less than one, a depreciation could actually worsen the trade deficit, at least initially, because you're paying more for roughly the same volume of imports and not earning much more from exports.
Wow. So just making your currency cheaper isn't a guaranteed fix for a trade deficit.
Not at all. And crucially, in the short run, demand for goods often is pretty inelastic. People and businesses take time to adjust their buying patterns. Contracts might be in place.
And that short run versus long run thing, that brings us neatly to the J-curve effect, doesn't it? It almost sounds like a graph shape.
It does. And it perfectly describes this pattern, the short term versus long term effects of a depreciation on a country's current account balance, which includes the trade balance. The curve tracking this balance over time often looks like the letter J.
How so? What happens?
Well, immediately after depreciation, the current account balance might actually worsen. It dips down first.
Worsen. Why?
Because as we just said, import volumes don't fall immediately, but the price you pay for them in domestic currency goes up right away due to the depreciation. Export volumes also don't rise instantly, even though they're cheaper for foreigners. So the import bill goes up before export revenues really respond. That's the initial downward part of the J.
Okay, so things get worse before they get better.
Exactly. But over time, maybe several months, or even a year or two, things start to adjust. Consumers find domestic alternatives to expensive imports. Foreigners start buying more of the now cheaper exports. As these quantities adjust and demand becomes more elastic, the trade balance starts to improve, often significantly. And that creates the upward swing of the J shape on the graph. It recovers and then surpasses the initial point.
Fascinating. So that initial pain is followed by a gain, hopefully, the J curve. Right, so we've really covered some ground here. We went from the basic numbers, the nominal exchange rate, through the real rate, the trade-weighted view. Then we looked at how rates are managed fixed, floating, managed, and the language used, devaluation versus depreciation. And finally, we dove into these deeper impacts, like the Marshall-Lerner condition and that very characteristic J-curve effect. It's really clear that understanding these exchange rate movements is absolutely essential for grasping how economies, well, how they interact on a global scale.
Absolutely. These shifts, which might seem abstract, they profoundly influence so much. A country's inflation rate, its trade performance, overall economic growth, even its competitive standing on the world stage. And, you know, for policymakers, it's this constant navigation, this complex terrain. They're always trying to balance exchange rate stability against other really crucial goals, like keeping employment high and prices stable. They have a perpetual balancing act, truly.
Yeah, you can really see that. So think about it. The next time you see a news headline, maybe about your own currency strengthening or weakening against others, you'll know it's not just some number flashing on a screen. You'll understand it's this complex interplay of market forces, sometimes deliberate policy decisions, and these global economic ripples. Ripples that directly affect everything from, say, the cost of your next vacation abroad to the price of goods in your local shop, maybe even the stability of jobs in your community. It's a really fascinating dynamic system. And getting a handle on these nuances will immediately means you're already one step ahead in understanding the real heartbeat of the global economy.